Atomic batteries to power. Turbine to speed.
Now, everything old is new again. America's entertainment pop culture talk show.
It may well possess a rudimentary intelligence.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Felt a great disturbance in the force.
Hello, I'm Mr. Ray.
Come on, Mark, like a job for me.
Where's the goodies?
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
I bet you wouldn't have done anything like this if Mom and Dad were here.
You filthy criminal.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Here are your hosts, Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Our future, everything, it's all riding on this company.
You got a guilty conscience, and this is what you come up with? That's it. That's all I got. I promise I'm going to bring us back.
Let's show people how rock and roll is supposed to make you feel.
Heaven knows they want to bring you.
Welcome to Everything Old is New Again. This is Douglas Viviani, and that is a little piece of the promo of Vinyl, a new HBO show that will be premiering this weekend on HBO Sunday night at 9. I'm here with the ever cinematic David Cohen. How are you today?
I'm great. I'm really excited for this guest.
I really am. Yes, we've been promoting this. We've got a terrific guest this week. Dave, I'm going to throw it over to you to do this terrific introduction. You read better than I do.
We have today, Doug. We have Terrence Winter, who is the creator, writer, and executive producer of the HBO television series Boardwalk Empire, one of my favorite shows. Before creating Boardwalk Empire, Terrence was a writer and executive producer of The Sopranos from the show's second to sixth and final season. And he's won 4 Emmys, 2 as a producer of The Sopranos, which won Best Drama Series twice, and 2 for working on writing episodes, Long-Term Parking, and Members Only, 2 very memorable episodes. And in 2013, he also wrote the screenplay to Martin Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. And of course, he's the creator, writer, and executive producer of the HBO television drama series Vinyl, which is set to premiere very, very soon.
And in fact, this weekend, Terry,
yes.
welcome aboard.
Thank you for having me, guys. Great to talk to you.
We're so happy to have you. Let's dig right into this. I have to ask the question that everyone asks you, I think. And of course, you're going to give us the exclusive on this.
Yes.
The question is Tony Soprano. Of course, you were on The Sopranos. You wrote 25 episodes. You won 2 Emmy Awards. You would know, is Tony Soprano, that character, still alive?
Well, that's the question I kind of throw back to everybody else. I mean, he's alive if you think he's alive, you know? I mean, that whole ending is, of course, very subjective, you know? David Chase, of course, who wrote it and created the show, never really took a position. And, you know, it's basically what you want it to be. You know, I always took away from that when you're a Tony Soprano, a guy like Tony, even going out for ice cream with your family is just fraught with paranoia. You're looking over your shoulder constantly, whether or not anything happened that night or not. At some point, somebody's going to walk out of a bathroom somewhere for this guy, you know, and it could have been that night, it could have not been, we don't know, and that was sort of, I think, by design, and that's what I took away from it. People have analyzed this thing to death and looked for clues, and I don't think there was any attempt on David's part to be cute or play a game with the audience. I think it was a way of, a very interesting way of telling the ending of that story and just really making you think. I always ask people, too, I go, you know, people go, you know, that drove me crazy, I didn't like it. And I said, well, what did you want to see? Did you want to see Tony get killed? And they said, no, of course not. I said, well, did you want to see his family get killed? No, I don't know. And I said, well, what did you want to see? And they said, I don't really know. And then it seems like, you know, once that ending settled in for people, they came around to it. They said, you know, it was interesting. It was something I've never seen before. And I think that was David's attempt all along. He was trying to entertain people and give you something different, you know, than the thing you expect.
Yeah, think about it. At the end of that show, just like many of those shows, many of which you wrote, there were some open-ended questions that kept you thinking and talking about things. And isn't that what life is anyway? I mean, when we pass away, is every question that ever came upon us or every problem we ever had resolved?
Yeah, I hope not. And for me, you know, as a storyteller and as an audience member, that's what makes it interesting. You know, somebody once said, you know, art doesn't give answers, it asks questions. And, you know, without, you know, saying that what I do is art, I mean, that's certainly what we aspire to. I want people to think, you know, I want to be challenged by something. I don't want everything spoon-fed, everything wrapped up in a bow. And I think this is one of the big faults of, you know, network TV, where everything is spoon-fed to you. Everything is so laid out. And if you don't understand what's happening, it's explained again in endless exposition. And there are close-ups of the gun in case you didn't see that the guy's holding a gun. And then the music swells. So in case you aren't sure that you're supposed to be nervous, we're telling you you're supposed to be nervous, and there's no doubt that they caught the murderer, everything's fine, and, you know, this is what happened. I much prefer having a show end and looking at my wife and saying, what do you think that meant? What do you think happened there? And having a discussion about it, and, you know, without sounding like a really incredibly old person, that seems like the way movies used to be in the 70s. You know, I remember walking out of, you know, things as a teenager, as a kid, and, you know, and having room for debate. And I think that was really cool. And certainly that's what I aspire to do.
And that's a terrific answer. Puts it just a great perspective. And you want to be challenged. I'm going to segue into my challenge to you.
Yes.
We'll play a small clip. Tell me if you, first of all, the first question is, do you recognize who this is?
Oh, knucklehead, you're completely exasperating, frustrating, and incorrigible. Gee, I wish you'd tell it to my mother. She thinks I'm a jerk.
That is taking me way back to my childhood. I'm going to say that that's Paul Winchell, and it's either Knucklehead Smith or Jerry Mahoney.
It's definitely, you're right on, it's Knucklehead Smith, and I'm going to tell you, I've got some crazy prepositions if you've heard our show. I'm going to say that without Paul Winchell, there's a possibility that that might have been one person that didn't vote for you to win that Emmy for Members Only, because that was a portion, if you recall, of course you do, of that episode where Tony Soprano was shot, and he had called Junior, if you right?
Yes, I think he referred to Junior as Knucklehead Smith.
There you go.
That's
very
true.
So you buy into that or no?
You know what? I that might have been enough for me to vote for somebody. Certainly, if I see some obscure reference to something, I absolutely fall in love. I love those little very inside pop culture references and things that are just amazing. There was there have been many times throughout my own work that I'll throw in references to movies, lines from The Honeymooners, or even come flat out and reference The Honeymooners. You know, for The Sopranos, you know, particularly, a lot of that, you know, these guys, you know, people just generally talk about movies all the time. Pop culture, television shows, movies, books, it's all a part of our life. It's very realistic to see guys like Tony and his crew talking about movies. I think actually in the second ever episode of The Sopranos, Tony and the guys are debating whether Godfather 1 or Godfather 2 is the better
right.
film.
Right.
Even so inside that they don't even call it Godfather 1. They just say, what do you think was better, 1 or 2? And
right.
they know exactly what he's talking about.
So I think what you're saying, though, is that if the show is on right now, and or if Tony Soprano is alive right now, he's listening to Everything Old Is New Again.
Absolutely, and talking about it with his friends, of course. But yeah, I mean, this stuff for me, I mean, I grew up, of course, you know, watching a billion hours of TV, like I'm sure you guys did.
Right.
And, I mean, it's so hardwired into my brain. I mean, particularly on the East Coast, you know, we grew up with WPIX Channel 11, which, you know, is a local station, and I consider, you know, more important to me than, like, graduate school. They rewrote The Honeymooners, the Bowery Boys, Abbott and Costello, all kinds of old black and white movies over and over and over again, constantly. And that's what formed the basis of my early sense of humor. That's what taught me how to tell stories. That's how I learned how to set up and pay off a joke. And for me, you know, it's funny, you know, thinking back, you know, sitting watching the Munsters after school and you know, and mesmerized by, you know, these ridiculous shows, having my mother come in and yell at me and say, you know, go do homework.
We'll play. Yeah,
right. And we'll be right back on Everything Old Is New Again with Terry Winter. Continue talking about Boardwalk Empire and Vinyl.
That's all I got. I promise I'm going to bring us back.
Sorry to cut you off there.
No, but that's okay. Now I get it.
But we still have another 2 minutes for for our local LI News Radio listeners here and anybody that tunes in later to the podcast. So I think that's probably why we got along a little bit there in law school, too. We all had the same sensibility. I shouldn't say all, not everybody in the class.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You and I and a couple of buddies that we kind of hung out. And
I got very lucky. You know, we were seated alphabetically, and I remember it was me, you know, you, Matt Bertucci, Brett Wolf. There's a whole lineup of guys who had the same sense of humor.
Right. You know, with the same, in the alphabet, the later portion of the alphabet.
I think, the later portion of the alphabet tends to be funny, although, David, I'm sure you're very funny, too.
we'll leave it there, because he is, there's no doubt. We'll hear that down the line. But in addition to that, as far as law school is concerned, we'll talk about that in the next section of our show and examine what we were like then and what brought you to where you are now. But do you ever just think back? And I mean, I know you've written in a name of a character that a fellow by the name of Lou that we know. He was in, I think, Diagnosis Murder. I think you did.
He
an
may
episode?
Have been in Diagnosis Murder. I think. He pops up every once in a while. You know, I'm very lazy. You know, sometimes it's easier to just when I need to think of a character name, it's easier to just use names of people I actually know. And then I always think, I'll just change it later. And then sometimes I forget. And then people end up as, you know, sometimes doctors and lawyers and sometimes, you know, serial killers or murderers. So depending on the level of sense of humor with various people, it varies how that goes over.
Well, there'll be no intellectual property lawsuit whatsoever. If you ever use the name Viviani or Colin, that'll work.
We'll be right
back on Everything Old is New again. Talk about Terry Winter and how this all began.
It's all riding on this company.
You got a guilty conscience, and this is what you come up with? That's it. That's all I got.
I promise I'm going to bring us back.
You're listening to Everything Old is New Again, America's entertainment pop culture talk show with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Hi, this is Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor, and you're listening to Everything Old is New Again.
You find something, not that you want to do. That's daydreaming. The need has to be as strong as a junkie's. See, a junkie doesn't want a drug. He needs it. Big difference. See, one thing is a kid wants a bicycle, this lady wants a mink coat, this guy wants a Jaguar, he wants a Mercedes-Benz. Those are daydreamers. You have to need it. That's the strength, the adrenaline. Well, my need is to perform. I'm a junkie in that sense. That's why I do what I do.
Welcome back to Everything Old is New Again. This is Douglas Viviani. I'm here with David Cohen. And we have a special guest this week, Terrence Winter, who's the force behind Vinyl, the new HBO show and series that will be airing this weekend, actually Valentine's Day, from 9 to 11 on HBO. Isn't Valentine's Day the 14th?
Usually is, Doug.
There you go.
Yep.
So I got that right. Now, trivia question. I know you know this because you just referenced the Munsters. Any idea who was speaking there out of character?
Well, if it's out of character, it had to be Al Lewis, but that sounded like Grandpa to me. I only know him as Grandpa.
Yeah, exactly. He never gets out of that.
No, they're kind of one and the same.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Even when I watch reruns of Car 54, he's still Grandpa.
He's still Grandpa.
It's Fred Gwynne and Grandpa.
Absolutely. I guess he did just hold. We've referenced them so many times on our show. They hold a place in our heart for sure. But I was surprised, and I guess I shouldn't have been. He was quite intelligent, at least in what he was saying there, and I therefore would assume that he's an intelligent gentleman, or was. I presented that because he was basically, the way I interpret that is, he was saying, listen, you find something that you love, go for it and do it.
Follow your passion.
And yeah, follow your bliss and you will be happy. Does that make any sense to you in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, I mean, you know, thank God I took that advice to heart or sort of, you know, it wasn't even advice so much for me. I mean, I kind of avoided following my dream really out of cowardice more than anything else. You know, I had a deep, dark secret growing up that I wanted to be a TV and movie writer. But growing up in Brooklyn in the 60s and 70s, I mean, you don't know anybody in the film business. I had no idea how to go about making that dream a reality. And it sounded crazy. It sounded to me like something other people do. I didn't know who these other people were, but it wasn't me or anybody I knew. So growing up, as much as I was a fan of television and movies, I never really fully committed to the idea, like, that's what I want to do, I'm going to explore that. Again, it just didn't sound like a legitimate way to make a living. I'm not sure that it does still. But, you know, it was sort of like, take the safe route, you know.
Right.
And for me, you know, I started out, you know, I grew up in a fairly blue-collar neighborhood, and I it was amazing I went to college. I actually went to a vocational high school. I originally started to be an auto mechanic. Somehow got into NYU, graduated from NYU, then thought, wow, you know, maybe I could be a lawyer. You know, that was like one of the only two important jobs I knew, doctor and lawyer. Mm. So doctor was out. But lawyer, I thought, you know what, I'm a good BS artist. Maybe I can pull this off. Went to law school, as you know. you know, could not have been less interested, as you can attest.
And let me stop right. We'll continue in a minute, but I want to play and set up a little picture in the listener's mind, because we had the same classes together, and I remember one specific event where we've got this fellow like going on and on like Kingsfield from The Paper Chaser. Let's just listen to that for 1 second to set the tone of law school.
You come in here with a skull full of mush, and you leave thinking like a lawyer.
We got this nasty, serious professor. He wrote the book on everything, and he wrote the book on, in this case, you know, procedures of how to bring a lawsuit about. And we're all digging in, and I'm taking notes, and everybody's serious. And there's this little scattering of behind the scenes, and I hear, you know, I hear Terry's name, and he was sitting. It was like an audience, kind of like a amphitheater. I turn around where he usually sat. We all sat in the same seats, and I don't see him. And I know he was in that class, and word has it. He's laying down on the bench or across two seats, taking a break during this very significant professor's presentation. It lasted with me these 30 umpteen years later. I cannot remember. I cannot believe that that was going on. Do you remember that?
Well, I was asleep.
So, you remember sleeping, that's for sure.
I don't take your word for it, but I entered law school with a head full of mush, and I left with a bigger head full of mush. So, unlike you and most everybody else in the class, I just should not have been there. I was there because it was a way to keep me out of the legitimate job market for a few years, and you know, I could tell people I was doing something, but I had no interest and no passion at it for it, and of course was terrible at it, because I just didn't care. You know, when I graduated, I ended up, you know, working in a corporate firm for 2 years, and I was absolutely horrible. Just was like literally within the first week, I was sneaking out of the office to go to movies and go into the bookstores and just, you know, absolutely just, you know, living a complete lie. And it was 2 years in where I was so miserable doing what I was doing that I didn't want to get out of bed and go to work in the morning. And it was more out of that than any kind of, you know, blow to pursue my dream than anything. It was more really born of misery that I finally just said to myself, okay, what is it you want to do when you wake up in the morning? And the answer was, I want to be a TV and film writer. And I finally was able to say it out loud. And it took me until I was almost 30 years old. I was 29. But once I was able to say that and admit it to myself and my friends and to my family and all of whom thought I was insane, the world opened up for me. I said, this is what I'm doing. I got to find out, you know, and there's only one way to do that. And I got on a plane. I sold everything I had. I moved to L.A.
Wow.
I got a share in an apartment. I took my law degree off my resume. I got a job as a paralegal so I could just work from 9 to 5 and come home and just write at night. And I lived like a monk. But it was so great. It was so clear what my mission was at that point, and it was exhilarating, because finally I was like, this is what I want. I know it.
And it was very similar to me, and I didn't cut you off, because I remember getting a phone call and you telling me this, and back then it planted a seed in my mind. Well, I always wanted to be on the radio. I hate to say it, you know, that's really one of my dreams, and I shouldn't hate to say it, but it was something that was buried, because you can't do that. You can't make money. Who does that? And there's no school to go for that, really, and there's no path and whatever. Do you think? So I didn't come out. I didn't have the courage you had until a couple of years ago to start this show. But I remember that. I still to this day remember that phone call in my office when I received it from you talking about this and admiring that, listen, this guy is going to follow his dream to blazes with anything else.
Right. And you know, it is a cliche. You know, people say, do what you love and you'll never work another day in your life. I swear to God, I feel like I haven't had a job for the last 30 years. What I do is what I would like to do anyway, whether or not there was money or not. If I won the lottery tomorrow and take money out of the equation, this is how I'd like to spend my days. Telling stories, making movies, writing TV shows. It's so, for me, so satisfying, so clearly what I was meant to do and what I love to do. And, you know, I always think, God, like, if I was born 500 years ago before TV was invented, what would I have done?
you'd be William Shakespeare is what you'd be.
I don't know.
In my view.
I don't know. Yeah. Well,
but I'll tell you, that, cause this, do you feel this, like, something inside of us as, you know, that we sometimes don't listen to, but regardless, is there this voice that's telling you what you should do?
Well, yeah, no, you know, more importantly, you know, the converse is there's a lot of voices telling you what you shouldn't do, and a lot of those people, you know, form your own negative impressions about yourself. You know, I always say, like, you know, there are probably five people in your life that, you know, if they encourage you the right way or discourage you the right way, can completely change the course of your life. Usually your parents, some siblings, a friend, a teacher. You get the right five people behind you, you can do anything. But if you get the wrong five people, you know, just breathing this negativity down your neck and you can't do this and dissuading you from trying things, it's really hard to pull out of that. And, you know, it took me a really long time to finally just say, I don't care what anybody thinks. I know in my heart this is what I want to do and this is what I was born to do and I want to pursue it. And, you know, a lot of that negativity, I think, is people, you know, they're saying, what they're really saying to you, they say, you can't do that. They're really saying, I can't do that.
Right.
I can't
right.
do that, therefore, why do you think you can do it?
Yeah, right,
you know,
exactly.
You think, oh, mister, who do you think you are going on the radio? Really?
Right.
You know how hard that is? I mean, you know, as all of us on this call can attest, I think every time, you know, if you would have stopped every time something was hard, you know, you'd still be working at McDonald's.
And if it wasn't hard, then everyone would be doing it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, even I remember going to law school. We said, you know how hard it is to be a lawyer? And I remember saying, by that point, I was already at least, you know, on my way saying, like, well, I guess I'll have to be as good as everybody else then, or work harder than everybody else because I'm doing it.
Right. And you weren't in the sandbox thinking, I want to go to trial. I want to do a preliminary conference order form, you know.
Right.
Like, you followed your dream, and we'll come on back right after this, continue to find out where that dream took Terry Winter. You're the oldest new again.
Now, back to America's entertainment pop culture talk show, Everything Old is New Again, with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Okay, what is happening now, Jay?
Well, we're going to return to Everything Old is New Again with Doug and Dave.
Oh, okay. I got nothing else better to do.
He's got nothing else better to do. That's Jay Johnson from Soap. We had a lot of fun with him. But you imagine the guts on that guy to actually... that was the promo
he
did.
It's great. Perfect.
We have
sums
a lot
us up perfectly. Nothing better to do.
Well, I'll tell you what. Our listeners are having a great time. We're having a great time discussing life and of course, the projects of Terrence Winter, who's a four-time Emmy Award winner, was a producer and writer for Sopranos, creator, producer, writer for Boardwalk Empire, which we're going to discuss now. And, of course, Vinyl is on this weekend. We're going to talk about that on the next section.
Yeah.
I can't wait to talk about Vinyl. It's such a unique project, talking about the 70s, the period piece, and record companies. And we'll get into that shortly. But right now, I just want to dig in for the fans, and there's tons of them, of Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah.
And what was your thinking in terms of diving into, Terry, another story of gangsters, be it in a different period? This was the 20s and 30s, of course. But in the same genre, is there something about the mobster mentality that you identify with, or what was that thinking there?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, as I said before, and I kind of was always interested in gangsters and crime. And it's funny, somebody asked me where did that start, and to really search my brain, it started from watching the movie Oliver, the musical of Oliver Twist. I was obsessed with Fagin and that gang of kids, that pickpocket gang, as a little kid, and I wanted to be part of that gang. And like a year later, The Sting came out, and I became obsessed with con men. And then, you know, growing up again in Brooklyn, you know, in and around kind of guys who looked and sounded like Tony Soprano, I started reading about gangsters, and The Godfather came out in 72, and I was way too young to have seen it, but I saw it anyway, and slowly I just became really interested in that. And as a teenager, I ended up actually working in a butcher shop that was actually owned by Paul Castellano, who was, of course, the head of the Gambino crime family. So kind of by osmosis, I was around that world. Of course, never had anything to do with it, but understood how these guys talked and sounded and thought and the mindset and the lifestyle and all of that stuff. So gangsters were something near and dear to my heart growing up. In terms of Boardwalk Empire, you know, I had just finished up Sopranos, where I'd been on it for, you know, five seasons, whatever it was, seasons two to the end. And HBO came to me and said, well, you know, we have, you know, a book that we own. It's basically the history of Atlantic City. Why don't you read it and see if you think there's a TV series in there somewhere? And I said, oh, okay, that's fine. And kind of on my way out the door, they said, oh, by the way, Martin Scorsese's attached to this. And I stopped in my tracks and I turned and I said, okay, yeah, there's definitely a TV series here, and I'm going to find it. And I went home to my wife, and I said, they just handed me a TV series. She goes, what do you mean? I said, if Martin Scorsese is attached to this thing, and I figure it out, they're going to make it. That's it. I said, right. She goes, all right, we'll go figure it out. So I read the book, and it was all literally the history of Atlantic City from the time it was a mosquito-infested swamp until, you know, last week. But there was a chapter on this guy, Nucky Johnson, who was the corrupt treasurer of the city during Prohibition. And basically, you know, here you have this guy who's already corrupt, and suddenly alcohol is illegal, and he owns a town on the Atlantic Ocean where all the alcohol comes in.
Right.
So overnight, he's best friends with Arnold Rothstein and Lucky Luciano and all these gangsters from around the country. I said, this is the guy. This is the series right here. There hadn't been a series about Prohibition since the Untouchables in the early 60s.
True. Right.
So I met with Martin Scorsese. I pitched him on the idea, and he said, yeah, great. You know, I've never really done anything in that era before. Let's do it. And that was it. We were off to the races. I went home. I figured out the pilot. I kind of fictionalized Nucky as Nucky Thompson. We cast Steve Buscemi, and the rest is history.
So let me – all right. Now, I'm a huge fan of Boardwalk Empire. Yeah. And so were a lot of my friends. So they were excited when they knew that we'd be talking to you as well. So when you have this idea now, because you read the book, what's the thought process like? Going in, you're not sure how many episodes this is going to last. So how do you plan out the story arc from beginning to end when you're not sure of the duration of the series?
Well, yeah, one season at a time. You know, I didn't know it was going to go beyond the pilot, you know, so
Right. Initially,
you know, the setup was, okay, write a pilot that, you know, hopefully sets up enough, you know, throws enough balls in the air that people are intrigued to see what happens next. So by the end of the first episode, you know, Nucky has met this woman, Margaret Schroeder. He's had her husband killed. His protege, Jimmy Darmody, has taken part in a heist in which several of Arnold Rothstein's men are killed. So there's all this conflict there. So it's really a question of setting up a satisfying story that is fraught with conflict that by the time it ends, you go, God, I want to tune in next week to see how he gets out of this.
Sure.
And then, you know, once we got picked up for the series, it was a question of arcing that out over the course of 12 episodes, which was our season one. And that was really a question of sitting and, you know, I kind of always make the analogy of it's like a road map. You know, we're gonna drive from New York to Los Angeles, and along the way we're gonna stop in Atlantic City and Chicago and St. Louis, and, you know, then, you know, maybe go over to Arizona and end up in LA. You know, those various cities being different story beats along the way, and, you know, hopefully, you know, we ultimately end up where we want to end up, you know, in episode 12. And it's really, you know, a question of sitting around a table with my writing staff and going, okay, well, where do we jump in? And you know, it's sort of following logically from the story we set up in the pilot. All right, what might happen now? Okay, well, Arnold Rothstein's going to find out that Nucky's involved in this, and what might happen then? Well, he's going to send some of his guys down. What's Nucky going to do? And it's just, you know, a lot of what if, what if, what if, and answering those questions is what makes the actual episode.
You guys, I love Steve Buscemi, and I've always wondered, you know, he's not your typical leading man. What went into the decision to cast him in this lead role? Did you guys look at him and say, yes, he's Nucky, we want him, and why?
Well, it's interesting, you know, Martin Scorsese, you know, I talked about it initially, and the real Nucky, had we been casting somebody who looked like him, we might have gone to Jim Gandolfini. But Jim had just done The Sopranos, and I knew that was not going to happen. There's no way he's going to do another gangster show. In any event, you know, as Marty pointed out, nobody knows this guy Nucky. Nobody knows what he looks like. It's funny, now people claim to know him, but when I was doing research at the time, I was in Atlantic City, and I was stopping people who were lifelong natives, and I said, you ever hear of Nucky Johnson? No. Everybody said no. Now when you go, they go, oh, yeah, my uncle used to work with him. I met him once. I was like, everybody knows him. But then I swear to God, nobody knew him. And there was a time for like a 25-year period, he was the most important guy in Atlantic City. But anyway, as Marty pointed out, nobody knew what he looked like. So he said, it doesn't matter. We're not going to try to cast a lookalike. Let's just throw out names of actors we love. Forget about what they look like, who they are.
I see.
And Steve's name came up immediately. Steve, who I'd gotten to know very well as a director and actor on Sopranos, I was like, well, I love Steve Buscemi. And Marty said, oh, my God, I love him. I worked with him once briefly. I'd love to work with him again. I said, me too. And we kicked around a few more names, and about a week later, Marty called me up, and he said, I can't stop thinking about Steve Buscemi. I said, me neither. He said, great, let's do it. And that was it. That was as simple as that. HBO, to their credit, was right on board immediately. They love Steve. And, you know, again, this is one of those things, like, had it been a network, they're like, you know, we want some leading man type. We want some really, you know, crazy, handsome, white-toothed guy, you know, with big muscles. And they got it, and the HBO got it immediately. Steve's great. He's incredibly compelling. He's always interesting. For me, every time I saw Steve Buscemi was in a movie, I'd say to myself, well, I know that part's going to be good. And
right.
then I thought, well, make him the lead of your show, then it'll all be good.
And he has the look and characteristics of a character that you remember,
absolutely.
But also can relate to, like, you could see him online at the deli, too.
Yep.
He really
morphs in and out of anything. He also has a great period look. Actually, when we were on The Sopranos, I actually went to see him in a play called The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy. And he looked great in those clothes.
That's great. We'll be right back on Everything Old is New again and talk about vinyl and see what's happening with Curry Winter.
You got a guilty conscience, and this is what you come up with? That's it. That's all I got. I promise I'm going to bring us back.
And just we have 2 minutes here again for our LI News Radio fans and people listening on the podcast.
I have so many more questions.
So throw another one out there. You got 2 minutes.
I need more than 2 minutes. You know, there's no way, Terry, you're going to be answered. I'm out of questions.
Oh, let's put it this way. I always found it interesting that you have real life individuals, Al Capone and, you know, lots of Lucky Luciano in the series itself as ancillary characters going through this. And of course, as you said, it was based upon a real life person. So how difficult is that to intertwine maybe what actually really did happen with your fictional activities of the boardwalk itself?
Well, that was fun, and it was a challenge. You know, I mean, one of the rules I made for us was, you know, I would never veer away from history in a big way. You know, for example, you know, Al Capone is a good example. You know, Al knew the real Nucky, and Al did spend time in Atlantic City. So I said, all right, well, therefore, then I am satisfied that Al Capone can be depicted in Atlantic City, and Al might have known a fictional guy like Jimmy Darmody. So I was comfortable creating situations with Al Capone interacting with that fictional character. I wouldn't, for example, have said, oh, let's do an episode where Al Capone goes to China, because I know that never happened. And that's stretching the bounds of the reality that I wasn't comfortable with. Or, for example, like if the timeline, like if something happened a month later than it actually happened in real life, as long as it doesn't materially alter the show or the subject matter, I was okay to take some artistic license there. For example, in the pilot, Big Jim Colosimo, who's killed by you know, Capone and Johnny Torrio, that murder actually didn't happen for several more months after we depicted it.
Interesting. We'll be back with Terrence Winter. Talk about Vinyl, his newest creation on Everything Old is New Again.
You got a guilty conscience, and this is what you come up with? That's it. That's all I got. I promise I'm going to bring us back.
This is Everything Old is New Again, America's entertainment pop culture talk show with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
When I started in this business, rock and roll was real and pure.
Mr. Finestra, is there a problem with the document?
We started this company from nothing.
Right, and now we're selling it.
I'm talking about our dreams, man. You don't understand.
Okay, here's what I do understand, Rich. You're high.
Yeah, what? So what? It's a privilege to do this job, to introduce the world to new music, to shape the culture.
Richie, we're going to be bankrupt in a month.
Going in a new direction, trying to bring us into the future.
Well, you're over there in the future. I'm here in the present, trying to keep the lights on.
Hey, we're about to turn a corner.
That's exactly what the Nazis told my Uncle Isaac. Showers, right around the corner.
Welcome back to Everything Old is New Again. We are here with creator, executive producer, writer, showrunner for Vinyl, and of course, we know the resume of the Academy Award nominated for Wolf of Wall Street writer, Terrence Winter. Welcome back, Terry. Thanks for coming
on
board.
Thank you.
That is a smidge of the promo is very long, so I tried to play bits and pieces of it as we go through the show. First of all, I just want to, maybe I'll ask you to describe what the show is about, and then we'll go from there.
Vinyl is the story of Richie Finestra, a record executive in 1973 who runs a company called American Century Music. When we meet him in a pilot, he's very successful, has a house in Connecticut and a beautiful wife and kids. He's been sober for many years, but he's kind of dead inside. You know, he's sort of lost touch with the things that got him interested and excited about rock and roll in the first place. During the course of the pilot, a series of events transpires that sort of reconnect Richie to the music and to that adrenaline coursing through his veins. And it's not necessarily good things that happen that do this, but by the end of it, he's sort of determined to get back on track, get back in the direction of the music, and to sort of take his company into the future with that in mind. So it's a really exciting time. It's 1973, really exciting time in the music business. 73 was the year that punk, disco, and hip-hop were all invented within about a five-mile radius of each other, within about a five-month period of each other. So really interesting time in the music business.
And it's interesting time to look back. I don't think, other than that 70s show, let's face it, recently there hasn't been much at all in that decade or showing that decade, which was an exciting decade, an interesting decade, especially for music. And I don't think we've seen, I'm trying to rack my brain, the closest thing you kind of get to is WKRP in Cincinnati. That's not fair. It's not even close to the record business. I mean, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing else
yeah,
that show.
Yeah.
So this is, I think, a tremendous ripe area for exposition. I think you've done a great job to dive into this one. Now, I see Martin Scorsese is in on board with this. Mick Jagger is on board with you on this. You know, so obviously I'm in good company when I make my conclusions like that. But long story short, in that vein, what participation did they have in the creation of this or even the production of this show?
Well, it all started with them, and I co-created the show with them, actually. In 1996, Mick Jagger approached Martin Scorsese and said, hey, why don't we do a movie set in the world of rock and roll? You know, sort of like Casino, but in the business of rock and roll. So they developed this as a feature project, and that went on for several years, for over 10 years, actually, before I got involved. They had a couple of feature scripts that weren't really quite working. I got a call from Martin Scorsese in 2007, and he said, hey, listen, I'm working with Mick Jagger on this movie about rock and roll. Do you want to be involved in it? And I was like, yeah. It's like, oh my God. You know, so it's like Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger. So I wrote a couple of versions of it as a feature film. We got it where we wanted it. We were happy with it. And then the world economy collapsed. Suddenly, the appetite to make a three-hour period piece set in the 1970s, or rather spanning, literally, at that point, the feature spanned 40 years from 1959 to the 90s. It was this big epic roller coaster ride. So the appetite to make a movie like that was completely gone. So the project looked like it was dead, and it was actually my wife, Rachel, who said, why don't you do it as a TV series? You know, we were already doing Boardwalk Empire, and I thought, great. So we pitched it to HBO. They were on board immediately, but then I had to go back to the drawing board and completely reconceive this movie, again, that spanned 40 years, and sort of park the story in one era. And that era that was most interesting to all of us was 1973.
Now, I've heard a little bit that Martin Scorsese has mentioned in the past that he, back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s himself, was always thinking of making a movie type of television show. In other words, he had great ideas for movies, but 2 hours, 2.5 hours, not enough time to explore all that he wanted to do with these characters. So something new came around, and you tell me, is it something new where you're now doing a TV series that, you know, is just an explosion of ideas from an original movie idea?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little different. I mean, I think, you know, the movie spanned 40 years in this guy's life. We're, you know, this series is more traditional in the sense that, you know, the season one takes place in about a six-month period in 1973, and then I think as the series progresses, it'll stay in the 70s. But, you know, from Marty's perspective, what he was talking about was the whole idea of, you know, long-form storytelling. You know, when we first started talking about the series, you know, to put it in his terms, he said, oh, okay, so the TV pilot is like the movie, and then everything that happens after is like after the movie. And I said, right. Yeah, exactly. And so he's like, as if you went home, you know, if you came back the next day and Travis Bickle, you know, gets in the cab again, and what happens to him today? And you just follow that. And he's like, wow, you know, really cool. So we started talking about, right, where might these characters go? And certainly on vinyl, that's what we're doing.
Now, when we meet with him every Sunday, or at least did in the past, who's cooking the pasta?
Oh, usually I would eat before I got there. He likes to meet late at night. He's a night owl.
Ah, there you go. Okay, now turning the tide a little bit, you've got a gentleman that's from Boardwalk Empire, won an Emmy in 2013 for Outstanding Actor as the lead in this project. You've got Ray Romano in a serious role,
yep.
A little bit there, Andrew Dice Clay in a serious role. Of course, there are other people involved in the project, but it's so exciting to see people that you've seen before but doing entirely different things.
Absolutely. I think, you know, people, you know, when they hear Bobby Cannavale, you know, a lot of people are familiar with Bobby's work. Of course, he won an Emmy for Will and Grace. He's an incredibly versatile theater actor. A lot of people know him as Jip Rossetti from Boardwalk Empire, and they go, oh, my God, that guy's crazy. Every time he would come on screen, I would cover my eyes. You know, I mean, it's like my sisters are terrified of him. And he's actually the sweetest guy in the world, of course. You know, so I think you'll see a different side of him. Ray Romano, you know, of course, everybody knows him from Everybody Loves Raymond and various other roles. You know, here it's a serious role. It's a very dramatic, very compelling character that he plays. He's Richie's partner. Richie Finestra is the character that Bobby Cannavale plays. You know, Ray, you know, of course, brings with him a certain humor, but, you know, again, very serious. Andrew Dice Clay, again, you know, he can't help but be funny, but very serious, very dramatic role, and I think people are really going to be blown away by what he does in the pilot.
Now, why comedians and you could have chosen anybody, why comedians in serious roles?
You know, a lot of that has to do with our incredible casting director for the pilot, Alan Lewis, who, you know, brought these guys before Marty. Marty's, you know, very famously worked with comedians in dramatic roles. Don Rickles, if you remember, was in Casino. Kevin Pollak was also in Casino. I think Marty likes comedians. For my money, comedians are often better dramatic actors than dramatic actors themselves. There's, I think it takes a bigger range to be funny and dramatic at the same time. And it's funny, when you watch Ray Romano, he can do more with his face, more with a look, than some actors can do with an entire page of dialogue. There's so much depth there, so much emotion, and I don't know what it is. They just really, it just really works. It's funny, Marty wasn't even aware of who Ray was when he cast him. Ellen
really?
Lewis brought Ray in and said, you know, Marty saw the tape, said, yeah, this guy's really good. She goes, you know, that's Ray Romano. Marty said, well, who is he? She said, well, he's like one of the biggest sitcom stars ever. And he said, oh, well, he's a really good actor. And that was the basis upon which Ray got cast, which was great. You know, again, there was no preconceived notion of what he could or could not do. Marty just responded to him as an actor.
Wow. Well,
this is going to be a tremendous series. I can't wait to see it. It's on this weekend on HBO, 9 o'clock. It's a two-hour premiere. The show's usually going to be 1 hour thereafter, I guess, right?
That's right, yeah.
All right, and this is going to be tremendous. 9 o'clock on Valentine's Day. Perfect thing to do after having
nothing
a nice Valentine's
Day. Nothing says love like cocaine and rock and roll music.
That's what Doug says to start every show, Gary.
That's my catchphrase.
How did you know that?
Get that on a T-shirt.
You've heard the show before.
You see?
Anyway, thank you so much, Terrence Winter, for spending the hour with us. We can't wait to talk with you again and enjoy Vinyl.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right, come on back to Everything Old Is New again next week. We'll explore something else in pop culture and entertainment.
You got a guilty conscience, and this is what you come up with? That's it. That's all I got. I promise I'm going to bring us back.
All right, we're back for one more minute. So is there anything we didn't cover about Vinyl that you feel you want to put out there?
Not really. I mean, unless you want to ask me something else.
Well, sure. How about like Mick Jagger's participation? He lived through that era. I mean, he's got to be a great resource here, huh?
He is the ultimate resource. I mean, he's got the biggest rock star maybe in history, literally, you know, a phone call or an email away, you know, to sort of clarify or expand on stuff we're talking about in the show. I mean, he lived through this business since, you know, the early 60s and has seen every aspect of it, from dealing with record companies, being on stage, writing songs, being in the studio, groupies, parties, flying in jets. I mean, anything you want to know about, he's done it. He lived it. He's still living it. He's actually on tour as we speak. So, this is, what an amazing resource.
And so are you. We really appreciate the time so much. Thank you very much. Good luck with this series.